Hey everyone, welcome to Just Mental Health with Stefan M, the podcast where we discuss mental health issues from a social justice lens. I'm Emily.
And I'm Stephanie. A quick disclaimer before we get started. We are mental health professionals, but this is not to be taken as professional advice.
We are also aware that our privilege may cloud our perspective on some topics, and we not only welcome but encourage you to message us with criticism and correction. Let's get started. Our business of the week is Rachel B. Rachel B. Oh, I get it. Is her last name start with a B? Okay, Rachel B. Planning.
Yeah,
I get it. Sorry. So, okay, so Eddie, so I'll tell you who she is first. So she has an Etsy shop called Rachel B. Studios. And her Instagram is Rachel B underscore planning. And I didn't understand that till just now. But so she does looks like little like stickers. I'm seeing all stickers. Is it just stickers?
Stickers and like planners and organizers and stuff like that. I think she's going to be doing all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
She just started her Etsy, so it's really new. But she's gotcha. Yeah, she's an artist. She teaches art. She's a teacher, and she's a really good artist too. So
she's a friend of Stephanie's, obviously. I'm just looking at her Etsy shop. But yeah, I mean, it looks really, like, she has really cute designs. She has really good reviews. Like I said, her Instagram is Rachel B underscore planning. High school art teacher, happy planner, Etsy shop owner, Rachel. The name of the Etsy shop is Rachel B Studios, daughter, sister, friend, forever finding ways to be the sunshine. Yeah, so find her on Instagram or on her Etsy shop, Rachel B Studios, if you're interested.
Cool. So we have a guest today, and I'm really excited about this one. I always say that about all of them, but I like when we have guests that talk about stuff that we don't know, or at least I don't know a whole lot about, because I feel like I get to learn from someone's firsthand perspective, and hopefully you guys listening get to learn as well. So today we have Morgan Rumpel Whiting. And she is an advocate, activist, and survivor of sexual and intimate partner violence. Morgan, thank you for being on our show.
Yeah, thank you all. Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you, Emily. I'm really excited to be here and really just be able to share some insight and experience with everyone so you can maybe understand a topic you don't hear that often or from a perspective you may not hear that often. So thank you all for inviting me here.
Yeah,
thank you. And I guess it might just be good for us to put out, I don't know what we're going to talk about, because we kind of do these things, we try to do them very organically. But since we are going to be talking about sexual and intimate partner violence, there's a trigger warning, a content warning for anyone. If that could be sensitive or upsetting to you, just be aware that we'll be talking about that. And this may or may not be the episode for you. So just want to throw that out there. So Morgan, you said you're an advocate and an activist. Can you tell us about the work that you do?
Sure. So I grew up a Black woman. I was going to say obviously, but people can't see me right now. So maybe I need to make that clear. So I grew up adoptee of a transracial adoption. I grew up in a household with two lesbian moms, and I grew up in Southern Indiana, a rural community. So I like to start out and say that about me because those elements play a huge role into why I do and what I do today. And so when I graduated from college in 2013, I graduated from Hanover College, and I left there with the mindset that I was going to go into some type of international politics field. I was going to do politics. And after I graduated, I said, well, eventually I'll do that, but I want to get a little bit of experience doing something else. So I actually moved to New Orleans, and I was in AmeriCorps with their Age United program. And so I was providing outreach to communities, education to communities, services, counseling to those impacted with HIV/AIDS, And then I was also going into communities where you may not have conversations about healthy relationships and healthy sexual relationships. And I was going into schools and having, you know, a lot of conversations with kids. And it was actually that experience that kind of changed the direction of my life. I was going into these schools and I was going into classrooms that were predominantly made up of Black students, if not all Black students. And I was going in to talk about healthy relationships and you know, things like I said earlier, sexual relationships. And sometimes when the kids would come in, you know, they would say, I'd go around and do a check-in and a kid would say, you know what, yesterday, I'm doing okay, but yesterday I saw my uncle get shot. And those type of situations when you're in, you're coming in to talk to somebody, but you can't have a conversation about a healthy relationship when a kid is going through that amount of trauma. Mm-hmm. And that's really what changed the direction of my life. So when I moved back from New Orleans, I went into direct service and I began working with survivors of sexual and intimate partner violence. And I was providing outreach. I was providing support when they were going to the hospitals or maybe to the courthouses. I was providing crisis management. And really just figuring out ways that we could best serve survivors of this type of violence. During that time, I was also experiencing sexual and intimate partner violence myself. And, you know, I will tell you that even though I was experiencing that, it didn't occur to me, even though the work I was doing, And I like to start off like saying that because, you know, it wasn't until later on in life. And there's a lot of things that happened, especially when in terms of mental health, that led me to be able to realize that I wouldn't have done it otherwise. And so I was experiencing that. And I was also working with survivors directly. And I ended up actually transitioning out of direct service. And I started doing work on systems. And the reason I did that is because I was starting to realize in some sense, after a lot of work with therapists and a lot of work on finding myself, self-esteem again and my self-awareness, that I was a survivor and I needed services, but there weren't services that I could access out there from people that looked like me. And I didn't feel necessarily comfortable going into those places. In addition to that, I am a Black woman, and no, I did not feel safe and secure to call the police. No, I did not feel that people were going to believe me. There's the stereotype about Black women in this country that we have to understand. We're very sexualized. So a lot of things played into the fact that I wasn't myself out and, you know, telling people I was a survivor, but I was still trying to help people. And that's when I transitioned into macro social work and I started working on those systems. Today, I am the statewide sexual assault response team coordinator with the Indiana Coalition on Sexual Assault and Human Trafficking. And what that means is I actually ensure that every county in the state of Indiana has a sexual assault response team made up of prosecutors, advocates, nurses, and law enforcement. And I train them to properly respond to sexual violence cases. So I train a lot on trauma-informed care. I train a lot on cultural fluency and make sure that if there are survivors, because there are survivors that look like me, because we know that Black women are one of the groups in this country at the highest rate experiencing intimate partner violence and sexual violence. And if they're not coming through your doors, if they're not seeking out help, it's not because of them. There's a lot of things that we have to change so that the doors open for people that look like me. So that's really why I do and what I do today. There's a lot of other elements. I'm sure we'll get into it. But you know, that's just a little bit of an overview about who I am in a nutshell.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Like you've done some really amazing work.
Thanks. I will say that, you know, another thing that I do today that's kind of on the side, it's not really, I would call it more of a consulting type position. I actually created a training that's called Why Colorblindness Doesn't Work, why and how we build culturally fluent sexual assault and intimate partner violence programs. And that training is designed to educate people kind of the way that I feel I needed to be educated in some sense. There's not a lot of conversation that happens on an educational level about historical trauma. And I was realizing that, again, there's a lot of reasons. There is a reason I didn't want to call the police. That's because of historical trauma that's impacted people that look like me for centuries. And that's why I didn't do it. There's a reason that people may not be reaching out to get those services or reaching out to get the help they need. So this training that I created is to take professionals through a walkthrough of history and looking at how trauma has impacted the Black community for centuries now, and then translating that and looking at a case study of a young girl who was experiencing sexual violence and human trafficking, and looking at that and looking at what ways could we better support those individuals. So it's a training I'm really proud of, and I've been training it across the Midwest at this point, and hopefully going to build that out even more. And it's something people are really eager for. So again, at the end of the day, my goal is just, if someone walks in the door that looks like me, I want them to get the best services possible.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I mean, there's quite a few things there that, you know, stood out to me, but when you were talking about, you were teaching and having these conversations with kids about healthy relationships, mm-hmm. and then you were in an abusive relationship, and it was sort of not fully, like, you knew that something was not right, but it probably wasn't fully like, okay, this is exactly what I'm talking about. This is not okay. Mm-hmm. And that sort of, that thing that happens, like, just because we are in this field or because we know a lot about a particular topic doesn't mean that we don't get affected by it or impacted by it, and doesn't mean that we always know exactly how to help ourselves.
Right.
You know, we are good at helping other people, but not always about helping ourselves. And then, of course, yeah. the, like you said, the systemic issues that were impacting why you weren't contacting the police or, you know, seeking out these services. And I think that's really important to remember. That's one of those things that when people talk about, well, why didn't they leave? Why didn't they get help? Why is there not a police report? Right. As if that somehow does anything. You know, regardless of the fact that people of color and those groups do not have the same sort of privilege that, you know, that police believing them or helping them or anything, but right. even the groups that do, it doesn't do much to go to the police. There's a lot of red tape really around protecting someone from intimate partner violence. And so what's the other thing that's interesting is you said now you're doing this training and you're working with police officers to yeah. train them, right? So what is that like for you?
Great question. So last year, actually, I came forward with my story only last December. It was December of 2019. Another survivor had actually come forward before me. And, you know, that honestly gave me a little bit of feeling like I had that space. And, you know, I came forward, I spoke out, and I didn't speak out again until, you know, I was kind of coming in contact with my perpetrator within the movement. So, you know, we're in Louisville. I was very active downtown and within the movement space around Breonna Taylor's murder. And within that, I was also realizing that, you know, there was a lot of issues within our movement space when it came to protecting survivors of violence and when it came to holding people accountable. So last summer, this and really still going on now, there was that going on. And there was also this feeling of, you know, I'm marching down the street, I'm walking down the middle of the street, I'm doing nothing but marching and being peaceful. And, you know, we look up and there's a police officer, you know, looking at us and acting like he's slitting his throat. And all we're doing is marching down the street. Now, think that not only did that impact me in my professional world, but that had a great deal of impact on my mental health. Mm-hmm. I felt in danger. I felt threatened. I felt like there was nothing else that I could do. It was purely on the fact that I was a Black woman. And that hurt. And that experience has, you know, very frankly, that has played a role in my professional career. What I've decided to do with that, that feeling that I've had, is I've been really trying to push for Indiana to look at other forms and ways to bring justice, like the transformative justice system process, if you will, and restorative justice process. So those processes are rooted in community accountability, and it eliminates the need to engage the state. So for Black survivors, and really not just for this type of violence, but for many forms of violence, this potentially could be a better way to actually seek out justice without having to engage police if you're not comfortable that way. And it allows me also as an advocate, a Black advocate, to put energy into finding those forms of justice as well, while also working to figure out if we're going to have the state around, if we're going to have people in law enforcement, the least I can do at this point is make sure that they're, I'm playing my part, that they're responding to the survivors the best they can. So that's really how I've transitioned that, to be really honest. And I think, you know, I'll be honest, I think people are hearing me on this transformative justice and restorative justice process. So, you know, it's something that we've seen a little bit in Louisville. It definitely needs to be better and more enhanced. I know that we've been reaching out to people across not just this country, but people who have done things like transformative justice in other countries, who have dealt with things like, how do we hold accountability for people who experience sexual violence? Mm-hmm. So trying to bring that knowledge in and incorporate it into what we do, into our community. So that's really how I've been, you know, trying to transition that energy. It was tough. I'm not going to lie. It was tough. Mm-hmm. And I will say last year, you know, I can only speak for the people within my field that I had conversations with who were Black. It was really hard to show up. It was really hard to show up for our jobs last year. Every day, especially, you know, I won't even say especially Louisville, across this country, it was like going at war every day just to breathe, you know, just to feel like, if I am walking in here and trying to train you as a police officer, are you going to hear me? Even though I'm standing up in front of you as a Black woman, those things were hard. It was hard to stand up and feel like you were important. So I do want to bring that out. It's been hard to transition that energy, but it's also been hard to show up. So we're doing the best we can.
Yeah, no, I mean, it sounds like, you know, I appreciate, you know, I feel like a lot of, it's not common that people, like, you used the word hurt, like that hurt me, like when you saw the police officer doing that, that harmed my mental health, that harmed my sense of safety. Those are really strong words that I wish, you know, I wish that more people like felt. I wish that was more understood, like that it is that deep of an impact.
Right. Right. I think when you say safety, that's huge, Emily. Safety is when you don't feel safe. And I know that, like, people, Black communities haven't felt safe for a very long time. Right. But when you feel that heightened sense of not being safe, I mean, all last year, I remember laying down to go to bed. Oh, crack my window open, the blinds up just a little bit so I could just see to make sure no one was trying to come up on my house. Just because we're marching. And those kind of things, like, just not feeling safe, that impacts your ability to sleep. It impacts your ability to then, if you don't get sleep, take care of yourself the next day. If you're always looking out the window, it's scary. And it also impacts your ability to trust people. Mm-hmm. And when you can't trust people, that also has a really big impact on your mental health. Yeah. Because you're constantly feeling like you have to be silenced in a way. So
much mental energy, like, to where you can't even, like, unwind and relax and go to sleep in your own home.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not even, sleeping in your own home is not even safe. You know, I think one of the huge things, at least for me, that stood out about, you know, Breonna Taylor, was like She was literally in her home, doing nothing, minding her own business, sleeping, and she was murdered. And I mean, that is a, I don't know, that seemed like a step up, you know, like just a, you can't, you're not even safe sleeping. And so I just, that was really
huge,
you know. Yeah, that's just really huge. And so that kind of level of having to look over your shoulder all the time, and you know, for a lot of people that have traditionally good relationships with police officers, so like most white middle class people, probably, you know, who do you call when like you're in trouble or you don't feel safe? You call the police. And you trust that they're going to come and they're going to check things out and they're going to make sure everything's okay. And when you don't have that, when you're not going to call the police because you'd actually be more likely to be harmed with the police involved, you know, what do you do? What is, where do you go? Who do you go to?
It was pretty lost. Yeah.
And then, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Emily.
Well, just, like feeling safe, like not wanting to go to the police out of fear of your physical safety, but you don't feel emotionally safe either. Like you don't know that they're going to believe you or that they're going to listen to you, that they're going to,
to blame you,
discredit you.
It's like you, when you do the work I do and you train people and you try to train systems so that there's change, you even more so know that. You know what I mean? Like I, unfortunately, as a Black woman, I know already, but I also know just from experience of what I've seen that when I call, like you said earlier, Stephanie, why don't they leave? That's something that's so, it's part of the things that I train people all the time. Because a lot of times, you know, people will, they don't understand that sometimes it's just safer, to not call the police. And then maybe that in danger of getting shot, just because we've seen that happen where victims will call the police and then they end up getting killed. So that's, you know, they're just going to leave people out. They're not going to tell people because they've seen so many other people just say, I don't believe you. You know, there's so many reasons, especially for Black victims, that we don't come forward. And so, yeah, all of that safety is compromised, the emotional safety and everything. I know something else that I was thinking about when you all were talking about that was when the decision came out about Breonna Taylor. You know, let me back up. Actually, during before that kind of verdict came out, if you will, I was hearing a lot of times on people respond and say, but her boyfriend was a drug dealer, but she was tied up in drugs. Having to hear that that's okay for you to think that you, that my life can be taken away. That hurts. That hurts. The other thing that hurts is that when the verdict or when the decision came out about Breonna Taylor, the only thing that people really cared about, and by people, I mean the systems, is that there were bullets that went through this white man's wall. Mm-hmm. Our life was less important than a white man's wall. Mm-hmm. This is a message that Black people have heard forever.
So but like,
to have to hear that again and again and again, and having to hear it again last year, again, how did you know, the ways that we're able to show up. I mean, Black people are some of the most resilient people I've ever seen in my life, because we still get up every day and we still try to help people out and try to make this better, even though we are just told that a white man's wall was more important than our life.
That's such a powerful statement. A white man's wall is more important than our life. Wow. Yeah, I mean, and it sounds like you've really channeled this into your work, really, really wanting to make a change. You know, which I absolutely admire you for that. And you know, different people deal with this racial trauma in different ways. And it sounds like that has has, you know, it is exhausting and difficult for you, but I'm wondering if it's also healing for you in some way to know that you are making a difference.
It is. I mean, you know, I definitely find strength in that. I find strength in any moment a survivor will come up to me and say, "Hey, I want to tell you." I feel strength in any time a Black person says that they are happy about something. Just that gets mm-hmm. me through the days. Those are the things that are important to me. Those are the important things that I think are needed to build the communities that we need. So it is hard, but I think even since I was young, and you know, I started out this whole thing telling you all a little bit about how I grew up. And the reason that all of that's important to me, being a Black girl in a white community with two lesbian moms in rural Indiana, I had to have some thick skin. Mm-hmm. I had to have some thick skin to get through that. And even today, you know, I talk about pretty often that, you know, last year through all of this kind of Black Lives Matter uprising, if you will, you know, I got married last June and I had an entire side of my white family not come. And they didn't come because I asked them to stand up with me. I asked them to march with me. I asked them to support me. And instead of doing that, they decided that, you know, I'm not going to come to your wedding. I'm not going to have a relationship with you anymore. And that was also an incredibly huge impact on my mental health. And what I tell people to that is, you know, I had to come to terms with the fact that for the most part, my white family wasn't ready for a Black child. They especially weren't ready for a Black child to find out that she was Black and to have joy in that. And a lot of people will ask me all the time, how do you keep going? I mean, how do you, you know, even though your entire family, because I have to stand up for myself because no one else will. Mm-hmm. So if at the end of the day, if I have to lose an entire side of my family because I had to say, hey, you're not doing enough to support me in my life, then so be it. Because I don't want my children around that anyway. So that's you know, where I had to end. And a lot of the experiences of growing up definitely just gave me the strength that I, you know, have today. I've transitioned. I have learned since I was a child to transition trauma into triumph. And so that's what I do because I have to. So go ahead, Stephanie.
Oh, I was gonna say, wow. I mean, that's really powerful. The impact that, you know, losing and the grief involved of losing a whole side of your family, because they don't want to stand with you because you're saying Black Lives Matter. I mean, that's literally the only reason at that point is they just don't want to stand and say, yeah, they do. And you're my relative. And I think that Black Lives Matter, like that's
Black Lives Matter is not a Black child. That's not Black Lives Matter.
Right. That's what I was thinking. Like, when people are like, oh, I'm not racist because I have a Black relative.
Right.
Well, when your Black relative asks you to show that their life matters and you say no,
maybe you should listen. Yeah. So y'all get it. Yeah. That's what I was looking for, just somebody to hear me. I mean, you know, there's always an incredible amount of pressure in society for you to fix your ties with your family. You know, I'm preparing to run for office. I don't know if I talked about that, on here, if I should bring it up on here, but, I'm in a program that emerged where I'm preparing to run for office. And I've even had, you know, thoughts brought to me of like, what will it look like running for office and not having any, you know, relationship with your family. And I'm like, you know, that's something I have to think about, something I have to work through. I don't know if anyone has done this like me before. And if they have, please hit me up. But mm-hmm. it's something that I have to work through because at the end of the day, like I can't not be authentic. And I can't be genuine for myself. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's so cool. You're running for office. That's
yeah. Awesome. Thanks. I'm kind of in the mindset of like, if it needs to get done, then I'll try to do it. And for me, I'm running because the conversations I want to have and the things I want to see done aren't really happening, or they're not part of the conversation. That brings me to another point I wanted to talk a little bit about, because it does have an incredible impact on my mental health. Mm-hmm. When I came forward last year with my story, the response I got, the response I got it's varied. But the one I want to focus on is the response I got from my community, the Black community. I learned very quickly that there is still this very strong mentality of keep it in the family. There's still this very strong mentality of like, don't bring that up because you're bringing my perpetrator was a Black man. You're bringing a Black man down. I had people who told me I was being a distraction. I had people who told me that my story wasn't believed because I didn't call the police. I had people tell me that I had one person who was a Black leader in the movement. I won't say who they are, but they were a Black leader in the movement, say that she did not believe I was attractive enough to be a survivor of sexual violence. Those are the things that those are the things I experienced last year. And that was really hard. And in addition to that, I'm on the front lines trying to fight against police brutality. And the only response I'm getting from people who are in my community is to call the police. I lost family last year. I lost my own family. I lost community within the Black community. And I also lost some of my survivor community. People were very torn with the way that I went about sharing my story. And losing that many people in one short period, just because you were wanting to keep other people safe and figure out a way to justice. How do you carry all that? Mm-hmm. And it's still heavy, and I just want to bring that up because I don't want anyone ever to believe that some of the trauma I experienced were from people that looked like me too. And I say it because one of my biggest goals now that I'm kind of doing on a side effort with survivor organizations in Louisville is to start having community conversations. So we're wanting to bring to the four communities in the kind of area, south, downtown, west, and east, and start having conversations about sexual violence and intimate partner violence, and trying to eliminate some of those stereotypes and beliefs about survivors, because I don't want that to be the response from my community. Because if that's the response from my community, I know that there's a lot of other people who are not coming forward who need that support. So at the end of the day, we have to break down systems, but we also have to break down our community systems too. The things that are protecting abusers and perpetrators, and we have to figure out a way to manage those. And so that, again, I guess back to me transforming some trauma into what are we going to do about this? But that's just the truth. I just want to put it out there that when it comes to being a survivor, you're going to face backlash from all types of people, and people who you may not even want to experience it from. So,
and that's really, that just further goes to show like, why don't people leave? Why don't they speak up? Even in the spaces where you should be the safest, other survivors, right, other groups that understand where you are coming from and what you're dealing with, we're still giving this backlash and criticizing you for how and when and, sort of the timing, and as if, if it had been different timing, if it wasn't during the Black Lives Matter protests, then maybe the response would have been different, but we know that it wouldn't have. I mean, it's the whole responsibility is put back on the survivor to talk about it, yes, and to, yes, and be criticized with how they do it. And that's just so, makes no sense. I mean, that's just the victim, yes, blaming is so deep. Yes.
It is.
even how you talk about it and when you choose to talk about it is criticized, as if, well, let's not focus on that. And let's focus on the fact that they are talking about this person who has done horrible things to them, who has hurt them and abused them and manipulated them and is a possible threat to other people.
Everyone wants to have
focus
an opinion.
What?
Is that everyone wants to have an opinion on how someone or if someone comes forward, but then they don't have, like, they don't have opinions on the issue, on the trauma itself.
Right.
And, you know, anyone coming forward faces this, but then a Black woman coming forward, as you've described, has this whole other layer of judgment and questioning that they face.
It's insane. And it just keeps it layers and layers and layers. And, you know, I think one of the things that stood out to me so much last year was the tremendous amount of people who were literally fighting alongside me, marching up to police. You know, I mean, all of the things that we did last summer, and then turning around and saying, I won't believe you unless there's a police report. That to me are people personally, that those are not the people that should be in this movement. You're not in it for the right reason. And so I, you know, again, just hearing those things, but bringing it down to, I won't believe you unless there's a police report.
The people about, that are marching.
Right.
Against police Black brutality.
That's
right.
And then, you as a Black woman to have a place. Yeah. I mean, the
right.
Irony is, it's stupid. It's ridiculous.
Right. And then you bring in, you couple that with the work I do. There are rarely cases that will go to court solely on a victim's testimony. I know that. So no, I'm not going to waste my time through the trauma of filing a police report just to be told, I don't believe you because it's been, you know, however long since you experienced your trauma. And since you didn't do it then I'm not going to believe, you know, I already know that that's what happens. I already know that's what happens. Why am I going to waste my time? And just to be told again that someone doesn't believe me. I already know the system doesn't believe me. So, it was an interesting kind of space to be in last summer. And just, you don't know what to say to people, you know, you don't know what to be like, but I'm fighting against police brutality. Also, you know, I will say to you all, you know, I do a lot of training. I don't think I mentioned this, but I'm co-chair of the Southern Indiana Human Trafficking Coalition. And I've been in that role for about coming up on 5 years now. And within that role, the coalition itself, we've trained thousands of people on responding, reporting, recognizing human trafficking. But in addition to that, you know, when you're doing that kind of education, you're also with the coalition, we're helping network, you know, survivors to services and things like that. And what we found, and this isn't just in, you know, Indiana or Kentucky, but what we see is, when it comes to human trafficking, a lot of the people who are involved in this type of crime have incredible amount of power, incredible amount of power. So I say that without saying too much, to just allude that another reason why I may not come forward is because the people I know who might be hurting people or trafficking people are the people who might be making the decisions of whether or not my life matters. Mm-hmm. And that's just being really frank. Mm-hmm. So though all of those elements, I mean, no, you know, I want to believe that this police officer might be good, but I've seen a lot of situations where the ones that, you know, we may trust the most. So anyway, I just say that to say that people with an incredible amount of power and having that type of power over you financially, emotionally, and physically, it's hard to escape. So back to that, why don't they leave? I mean, why would they?
Right. The whole situation and environment is set up to make it so that leaving would almost be not worth it. Like, with the systemic, but also from like the individual basis, you know, that sort of power and control doesn't just happen overnight. You know, I mean, you don't typically just wake up after, you know, dating someone and they're like, okay, I'm going to control everything about you now. You can't leave and you can't tell anyone. That's a process that is, that happens. Yeah. Abusers are really good at that process. And
very much grooming, very good at grooming.
And it's much more dangerous to leave most of the time.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
As a therapist working with trauma survivors, I feel like some of what they talk about the most isn't like what you would think is the like quote worst part. Like they talk about the buildup, the manipulation, and the aftermath. This is how my work responded. This is how my family responded. Like when I worked with teenagers, this is how my school responded. If they did report it, this is how the authorities responded. Mm-hmm. And we end up talking about those pieces maybe even more than the event itself, because those are just as, if not more, traumatizing.
Yep. Yep. I mean, I know that I would have survivors tell me, I would have survivors tell me that they would much rather deal with the physical than the emotional and mental, mm-hmm. because that's the kind of stuff that just carries on. And those are the things that can be some of the biggest barriers to you getting on your healing path. I think that last summer with the response that I was getting from people, you know, no wonder that survivors were just coming to me and not telling anyone else. No wonder. They were seeing how survivors being dragged through the dirt, the mm-hmm. names that I was being called, the things that, oh, but he's such a nice guy. He's never done anything to me. He never gave me that vibe. You know, you're hearing and you're seeing these things, and
that's gaslighting.
Yeah.
They seem like this super nice person so that everyone will say stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, they're not. And one of the things I point out in my colorblindness training is, you know, the case note that we use. This young girl, she saw her mom call the police and try to get them involved and help her out. And she says, my mom was treated more like the perpetrator than the victim. That had an incredible impact on whether or not she was going to report later. Mm-hmm. And again, that's one of the reasons I'm really trying to change, because not only from system-based, but community-based, if we don't do better at responding, we're never going to get people the help they need. And you should want that. You should want people to be healthy and happy in your community, because that's only going to benefit you. This is another reason why I'm kind of running for office. I'm really trying to build that type of conversation. I'm trying to address things that are not things that may typically be addressed in areas that, like where I live in predominantly Black, you know, neighborhoods, because we don't talk about sexual violence. We don't talk about domestic violence. And so that's another reason why I'm running. And, you know, I know this in kind of the area that I live, we really don't have mental health services. We don't have after school services, but yet, you know, a big focus is that we want to ensure that our communities are cleaned up. We want to make sure that, you know, someone has a nice yard. And my argument or my push is that in order to get those results, you have to have healthy and happy people. Mm-hmm. That's just, the mental health plays such a huge role in your ability, period. Just ability.
Right.
I will say that, you know, I've been receiving, you know, therapy services, good ones, for the last year. And it was definitely a process finding that too. I went through some things I wouldn't wish upon any person to go through, you know, looking for a good therapist. I went through a lot of microaggression, a lot of, are you sure that person was being racist to you kind of questions. But I understand what you're going through because I have a Black cousin or friends from my therapist. And those are things that, again, I'm trying to go in and teach that we cannot, because that shut me out. Mm-hmm. That did not make me want to continue to do therapy and do things like that. But I do have a privilege of being in the work that I'm in. And in that work, it's something that we preach and something that eventually I was able to inherit myself. So I am continuing to try being therapy. But I know that there are people in my community, if that would have happened to them, they're gone. We're never going to get them back in those doors again. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's just another reason why I do those. So I just encourage people, you know, especially people of color and Black women who are listening to this, look for support, look for people that are willing to support you and don't give up. I know that that sounds easier said than done, but it just, frankly, our mental health services for us are still in the works. We're still trying to make those a space that's safe for us. And I don't want to say be a guinea pig, but I just don't want you to give up. You know, look for a good fit for you and then center yourself or find a circle of people that are going to support you in that. It can be so easy to get wrapped up in finding people in your support, in your core group that aren't as dedicated to your healing. And so find people that are dedicated. That doesn't mean all your friends have to be your, what I've learned term is trauma friends, and which I love. I learned that in a survivor group I was a part of, and differing your trauma friends from your, you know, people you don't have to talk about your trauma with. So do that. Find people that are willing to support you. And there are survivor groups, especially on social media. The Sexual Assault Advocacy Network is full of survivors and advocates that, you know, you can connect with, or, you know, feel free to connect with me. And I can help point you in directions. It's something I'm really invested in, making sure that we are getting the things that we need. So
I was just going to say, that's a great resource. And we'll link that in the Instagram, for anyone who wants to access that. So yeah, thank you for sharing that and for giving that advice for people that are listening and are like, well, so what do I do if everything's against me? Where do I go? What do I do?
I was gonna mention a couple of the resources that we talked about it in another episode, but it's worth mentioning again. Therapy for Black Girls. I don't know if you've heard of that.
I have heard of that. Yeah.
It's a website, and then they have a Facebook page and an Instagram page. So you can, pick your state, and then it's like a national Black therapist directory.
Awesome.
And then Chicago has, can you guys hear that? Sorry, I'm a downtown Chicago. There's like a lot of noise. Since all of the protests, there's been a Chicago Black Therapist directory has been created. If any people in Chicago are listening, or in Illinois, you know, doing telehealth. So
that is so cool. I don't think Kentucky or Indiana has anything like that. We need to make one, because that's a good resource. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, and I'll also say, for allies or those in the mental health field, especially if you are not a person of color, as I'm sure that you all probably talked about and touched on in this podcast before, privilege. And I know that hearing that, some people are rolling their eyes, but privilege is very real. And it's something that, okay, so we know it's real. So how do we use it to make change? Mm-hmm. So I encourage mental health professionals and allies who aren't people of color to ensure and push your agency to make the decisions and make the changes that you can better serve all communities. So I always encourage, first of all, starting with a self-assessment. There's a lot of great tools online that you can do, but just doing a self-awareness or a self-assessment on yourself in terms of cultural competency and fluency. I always encourage people to go into a conversation knowing where you are first. Because these are difficult conversations. I still struggle to talk about race sometimes. I'm not going to lie. Like, I still struggle. It's still sometimes difficult to bring it up in a room, but do that and then encourage your organization or your business, whatever it might be, to look at two things. Number one, your policies and procedures. See if they're inclusive. See if language is inclusive. You know, I've worked with organizations before, just looking at language in terms of gendered language and mm-hmm. how do we better be inclusive of, you know, gender and sexuality in general. But look at those. And then in addition to that, also look at how you're delivering services. Do an assessment with that. Again, there's great tools. Once you've done those things and once you've committed as an organization to making those changes, I always encourage, don't stop evaluating. Don't stop and just think because you made one change and wow, this is like, look at us. We are coming out. We are all trauma-informed and culturally competent and all that stuff. That's great. But you need to keep making sure you're staying that way. So dedicate yourself to reassessment all the time and individually reevaluate everything that's going on. I just say all this. I'm sure a lot of people listening probably know. I just like to say it because, you know, sometimes you never know. Sometimes you never know who needs to hear that extra push or motivation or to hear from a Black survivor that we appreciate you doing that. Mm-hmm. It makes a difference and it matters. So, again, if anyone is curious or wants to talk more about that, has questions, or even if you want me to help out with a conversation with your organization or your business or company, reach out to me. I'm happy to do that. Again, I do it because I'm a survivor mm-hmm. and I want other survivors to get access to justice and healing. So feel free to reach out to me on Facebook or any way possible. And I'm happy to help with that.
Really appreciate that. Yeah. Another thing I want to mention, if you are a Black person and you're wanting a Black therapist or any mental health services, trauma care services, it is completely acceptable to say, I'm looking for a Black therapist, you know. A lot of people don't know that because, you know, of like, we're supposed to like not see race, whatever. So they think that like, they think that they have to be like, you know, like if we're on like the intake form of the practice that I work for, we ask, do you have any preferences, gender, race, sexual orientation? And, but if you don't, if like people, since we've added that to the intake form, people say it more, but before that, when it was just like a general question, like, do you have any preferences? People don't feel like they feel like it's like rude, like it's going to hurt a white therapist's feelings. And it's like, no, it's not. Like say what you need. Like if you are looking for a therapist, a mental health professional of any demographic, say it. It's totally cool. And we want people to get the best care possible. And so we encourage you to.
Right. Whether it's with us or anyone else, you know, that's not the important thing. Yeah, that's cool. That's something that I think a lot of places should also consider putting that option in their intake. I know we don't have it in ours. Of course, I work in South Central Kentucky and there's like no Black there. Well, actually, I think there might be one in the whole county, like the whole, county and surrounding counties. And so it's like, that's not even an option. Like, there's not even an option. If you wanted one, they wouldn't be available. So that does put another layer to
and
it.
And that's it's very common. I get that response a lot. And usually what I'll try to do is I will encourage organizations or whatever agencies to reach out and see if you can contract with other therapists. And I say that because sometimes in this work, I won't say necessarily in your all's maybe specific fields or your organizations, but sometimes this work can be territorial in some sense, or people don't want to share. If someone comes in and wants services from you, I'm not going to, even though we don't have, you know, any, I'll tell you, you know, we don't have any Black staff. Is that okay? Is there something, could we still work with you? If not, the best thing you can do is point that person into a direction or resource that they want. And so I just encourage people to try to, you know, walk out of the comfort zone, and it's still going to be difficult. You still may not be able to find anybody. But the good news is that you tried, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, on the flip side of that, we really have to start trying to recruit more people, black people into this line of work. And unfortunately, a lot of reasons that people don't go into work who are in this type of work that are black is sometimes they don't feel safe or supported in their organization. So they're really, that's why, again, I always encourage policy procedure and working to make sure your organization's inclusive first, before you start including survivors from other backgrounds.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Working from the top down, like if you don't have a safe space for black employees, then you're not going to be able to serve black.
So you're in Chicago. That's a, wow.
Yeah.
You must have access. You have access to probably a lot of black mental health professionals.
It's been such a change, honestly. I mean, I didn't ever work in Louisville. I only worked in Jeffersonville, Indiana, which is quite different from Louisville, despite the fact that it's right across the river. But yeah, I mean, you know, I've noticed a huge change. Just Chicago is just more diverse, more progressive in that way. There's still obviously work to be done. No one's ever, like you said, no one's ever done like, oh, we checked off the diversity and cultural competence box. Like, there's always more to do. Right. But yeah, it has, I mean, moving here has made me see just kind of how much work still needs to be done here, and even more how much work needs to be done in less progressive areas.
Right.
So, yeah.
Hope not to end on that we have more work to do.
always more work to do. But thank you so much for coming on again, sharing your story, sharing, you know, very personal things, sharing your trauma to educate other people, and the emotional labor that you put into this, because obviously you're not doing this for work. You're doing this because you want to share your story, and because, you know, we all went to graduate school together. I'm sure you're like, want to help some friends out, but that's very nice of you. And, you know, all the resources that you, that you talked about are going to be very, very helpful. And I hope that someone who is listening to this can hear their story in yours and realize that, like,
they're not alone.
The other side. Yeah. And there's triumph on the other side too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I feel like I learned a lot just from this conversation, and I really appreciate you being so open and all the work you're doing. It's amazing.
Thank you all for highlighting these voices. It's important.
Yeah. Happy to. All right. Well, that's our show. If you enjoyed this episode, please share with friends and family.
And don't forget to follow the show's Instagram for updates on new episodes at Just Mental Health Podcast. That is with a period between each word. We record a new episode every week. This is Steph.
And M.
And Morgan.
Signing off. Thanks for listening.